The next case for argument is 23-2226, Berry v. Dupuy Synthes Companies. We're ready whenever you are, Mr. Galloway. Mr. Holloway, I'm sorry.
May it please the Court. The two errors below of granting JMAL and excluding the Neal survey should be reversed. I'd like to begin with the exclusion of Dr. Yassir's testimony and application of the Court's claim construction, and then we'll turn to the others. Dr. Yassir was improperly excluded over his application of the claim term handle means. At Appendix 1237 through 39, Dr. Yassir repeatedly used the verbatim court's claim construction and slight variations to it in applying the construction to the accused products. For example, the question was, do the levers have parts especially designed to be grasped by the hand? Another question. Does that mean there is no part of the
deal? I don't know that it's disputed that on direct, at least occasionally, perhaps always on direct, he literally said he was applying the court's claim construction. But then we get to cross, and it seems like he said a bunch of other things that do look like they're in tension with the court's claim construction. If that's how we see the record, what should we do?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I don't think they're in tension with the court's claim construction. Your Honor is referencing the slide, for example. That's
for example, when he says everything in Figure 1 is a handle means, which could only be true if he's applying the court's construction, if everything in Figure 1 is especially designed to be grasped by the hand, right?
Exactly.
And so how is what he said?
Because what Your Honor has exactly pointed out is the difference between what is the claim construction and is an expert using the verbatim claim construction, like in the Inogenix case, and how is the expert applying the claim construction. In other words, what's the mental step between, yes, the court's claim construction is a part designed especially to be grasped by the hand, and explaining to the jury why or how that is. Two questions later, from the question Your Honor is pointing to, Dr. Yassir explained that the need for surgical tools is for surgeons to do what patients need, and the patients need them to be manipulated by hand, so they have to be especially designed to be grasped because that is how surgery is done, at Appendix 1256. The application is completely acceptable within this court's jurisprudence, like the Medvac Co. and some other ones that we cite. The application is okay, even if it's not the verbatim words.
What if the way I read the record is that in an effective cross-examination, counsel got your expert to admit that in his head, he doesn't really believe the court's construction. He didn't really apply it when he went through the mental analysis.
I don't think that's correct.
But if that's how I read the record. So on direct, he's really good about saying, I applied the court's claim construction. He says the words. But then on cross, we learn in his head, that's really not what he did or thought. What do we do with a record like that? Does that get played out in front of the jury? Or knowing that, should we have stricken this guy from testifying?
There's a difference between, for example, in some of the cases that we cited, where the construction is a line, and a party pretrial advocates for a construction that means a perfectly straight line. And the district court judge says pretrial, it does not have to be perfectly straight. Then you show up in front of the jury, and your application is, it must be perfectly straight. That's a violation of a claim construction. That should be excluded. The exact opposite happened here. The proffering party said that the construction should be a part designed especially to be grasped by the hand. Acknowledged at Markman during the oral argument at 16,000 to 16,001, the proposed definition of engrasping something by the hand could theoretically encompass every element of the accused products. Dupuy's brief at Markman at 16,429, Dupuy said that even the end of the handle, or even the end of the lever, is going to be part of Dr. Berry's construction. And we argued for that, and that was the construction that was given. And the district court judge told us, after Markman, at summary judgment and again at Daubert, quote, my claim construction contemplates an embodiment of the plaintiff's invention in which the surgeon grasps the shaft or lever rather than a separate part strictly designed for handling. That's at 15,642, citing to the Markman at 15,163. So that's the landscape pretrial. Expert takes the stand and says, I know it doesn't have to be a separate part strictly designed for being grasped by the hand because that's what the judge told us in the claim construction. How do I know that this thing in the DePue product has a part designed especially to be grasped by the hand? Because it's a surgical tool and those companies are building them to do that. That's the application of the why. Otherwise, all an expert is ever going to say when cross-examined at trial is, I use the court's claim construction, or just repeating the words. The one part of Your Honor's question I would like to go back to is, it was effective cross. Cross-examination of application is not an exclusion issue. That is not a violation of claim construction. That's a job for the jury to decide.
Did they move for judgment as a matter of law on the grounds that they got your expert to testify in contradiction to the court's construction? Was that one of their grounds for directed verdict?
No, their grounds for directed verdict was that there was insubstantial evidence. The judge ruled he was excluding Yasir's construction as contrary. They made that motion as a Daubert motion pre-trial. They renewed it as a Daubert exclusion. The judge then used it as JMAL. Does that properly answer your question?
Thank you.
And was this, I think with Yasir, the papers, or at least the court, invoked only 702, not 402 or 403. I think he invoked 403 on Neil.
Correct.
Okay.
On 403, there was a, even if it could
and
come
this
in.
Is 702, this is 702A, not helpful because contrary to the governing legal standard, namely the claim
correct. The violation of a court's claim construction order is a 702 problem.
702A
problem. Correct, Your Honor. There was separate evidence that should have had this case survive JMAL. Specifically, DePue gave the tools to the jury and had argued to the jury, anyone can figure out that this thing does not have a part designed to be specially grasped by the hand by making reference to coffee cups. Under the valve case, that would have been a loan. The jury can look at the part and figure out in a relatively simple thing as where is someone supposed to grab this, that they could have come to that conclusion. Moreover, they heard testimony that surgeons, DePue surgeons, had, for example, created constructs where you'd link three or more vertebrae on the left side, three or more vertebrae on the right side, and then connected them across with a connector and performed derotation. DePue's response to that, that's at Appendix 1391 through 92. DePue's response to this is that Dr. Betts said rarely, but this is a direct infringement problem. The question is, had it ever done? Had it ever been done? We have that testimony. The argument in response to that was it only applies to two of the three patents. Again, that kind of makes the point. The district court judge here was trying to exclude evidence so that there was nothing that could go to the jury when, in fact, there was evidence that when you take it in the light most favorable to Barry.
What you're now saying is, do I take it, is an argument that even if Yasir was properly excluded, JMAL was incorrect.
Correct, Your Honor. And we briefed that in both the blue and the gray briefs.
Okay, well, can I get to that, I guess? I mean, the patents are different. Similar but different. The 358 has two limitations and you have to meet both, right? And the second one is applying manipulative force, you know, simultaneously.
Correct.
Where is that testimony? Where is the testimony sufficient to support that?
Dr.
Yasir admitted, did he not, that he didn't? Does Yasir give you anything on that?
Yes, Dr. Yasir explains, for example, when he's testifying at about the surgical technique guides that DePue uses that are the instructions here, at Appendix 6358, 6214, 6150, these are the surgical technique guides. Dr. Yasir explains how, for the one at 6358, when you build that tool that's showing the application of manipulative force, you would only build that tool if you were to push on both sides.
There's testimony, is there not, that he said that none of the product literature shows manipulative force applied simultaneously to two different handlings?
That's in reference to the 6358, and two questions later he explains how the only reason you would build that tool is if you used both tools. For other ones where it actually is physically linked across the spine, for example, at 6214 and 6150, the actual surgical technique goes show moment arrows, the curved things showing that the thing is going to be turned. You don't build them and then not use them.
But what if we were to affirm the striking of Dr. Yasir? Can you still argue that you have sufficient evidence for infringement of the 358 with the manipulative force limitation without Dr. Yasir?
Yes. What I said before, they had the tools. They'd seen the tools themselves. They can come to a conclusion, given the court's instruction on what handle means and the rest of the claim, that they'll be told that it has a handle means. They've seen images at 6358, 6214, and 6150 of Depew's intention that the thing is going to be used to do derotation.
So you're saying that even absent Yasir, that they could look at 6358 and conclude that this consists of applying manipulative force to said first handle and applying manipulative force to the second handle substantially simultaneously?
But Yasir was only excluded in the court's JMAL order on the application of handle means, not the application of force.
So you do need him on manipulative force, but you're saying no one ever struck him on that.
I don't think he's absolutely necessary, but it's not the only evidence.
Believe even Judge Diamond did not strike him on that testimony?
That's in the appendix. He did not strike him on that. He only struck him on the application of the court's construction of application of
handling. Do you happen to have the appendix cites? Because as I said, there is one site where he said that none of the literature shows that they are applied simultaneously. So
you're asking for Yasir's site that manipulative force is shown? Yes. One second. I will confirm that, but I believe it's 1258. But if I'm not right on that, I'll correct that in my rebuttal time. I'd like to switch to discussing Dr. Neal for a second, if I can. Dr. Neal's testimony was improperly excluded because the court did not stay in its lane on the gatekeeping function.
Can I just ask a question? So Neal's survey was being offered both for damages and for direct infringement? Is that right?
It was offered for actually three purposes, Your Honor. Direct infringement, inducement. These are inducement cases, so being offered to prove up inducement issues, as well as assisting our damages expert in the quantification of infringing uses.
So the idea I have, and just tell me if this is wrong. It may be one thing to exclude a survey that's being offered to show the quantity of infringement as, you know, just a really bad survey. But if what it's being offered to show in part is there was at least one infringing act, the threshold for saying, okay, it's enough to show that would seem to be much lower. Is that, what do you make of that point?
I don't disagree with your point. I think that it gets to an interesting question on what we're testing here. We're testing the preponderance of the evidence that it's more likely than not that the survey was using sound scientific techniques.
But before we leave this point,
mm-hmm.
I understood his testimony to be for the purpose of quantifying infringement.
I would say it's incorrect, Your Honor. It had to be used for the purposes of tying, for example, the surgical technique guides and instruction that was being given by Depew to the surgeons. Much of the briefing at this court has all been about the first part of the survey, which is, were infringing surgeries done and how many? The back half of the survey, which we don't talk about in any of the briefs, had to do with tying those infringing uses to things like surgeon education sponsored by Depew, the surgical technique guides, the presence of sales reps in the room during these procedures. So it covered everything from, to Judge Toronto's question, direct infringement through inducement, and then ultimately was used alongside with the damages expert to quantify.
I guess to put the point in a slightly different way, have you made the argument that even if the methodological flaws were sufficiently great that under 702 it was not an abuse of discretion to exclude testimony about the quantity of direct infringement based on that survey, still, the flaws were not so great that it would justify excluding the testimony based on the survey to show, I think there's at least one direct infringement, which would seem, I mean, you would need, and you get the point. Have you made that argument?
I get your point, and no, and here's why. The test for the exclusion under 702 is have we shown that there's a preponderance of the evidence that the methods used by the survey expert are sufficiently tied to a scientific method? That's the only question that's involved in the 702 analysis.
Relevant to an issue in the case.
And obviously,
there are two different issues, at least two.
Correct.
That there was direct infringement and how much there was.
Yes, was there directly induced infringement and how much was there are the questions relative to the issue.
And isn't it possible that your method was reliable for one of those but not for the other?
That's where I was going with my answer. That's a weight question. That's where do we give him credit for what he did and what the survey shows and where we don't. And that's where this issue becomes, this was not a Daubert problem. It's not a 4013 problem. There's nothing in the record that suggests that this didn't answer the question of direct infringement, inducement, or damages. So we're done with 403. The Daubert question under 702 is, did the survey use reliable techniques such that the expert could rely on the outcome? The answer to that is yes. Dr. Neal testified at length from Appendix 1164 to 67 about his survey method of casting a wide net, screening them down, and comparing them to independent data. What I understand Judge Toronto you to be asking is, well, what if I don't like the outcome of that in terms of showing that there were exactly 3,000 surgeries? That's for the jury to decide to credit that. What if I want to say it only credited one surgery? Once we've crossed that Daubert threshold, your question has switched to how much weight should the jury be given the results. And we're not here to test the conclusions, and we're not here to test if it's right. The question is simply, did the record contain good grounds under Third Circuit law for him to have relied on it? There is no challenge in evidence, only argument, that there were certain things that Neal should have done differently. There is no evidence that they would have changed the result. There's not even evidence that what Dr. Neal did was wrong.
You tell us in your brief at 12 that Neal has been a survey expert in more than 40 litigations and survived 9 Daubert motions. How many did he not survive?
He has not ever lost.
Except
he's only been challenged 9 times and never lost.
Including one of them was
this court's decision in Berry versus Medtronic, where we used the same exact same methodology, which mimics the methodology used in GlaxoSmithKline and Roche. I've gone way over my time.
Yeah, but I have one more quick question. I hope you'll be brief, but I just, on cross-linking. What's your best evidence on cross-linking? Let's assume hypothetically we're getting rid of the cert, let's leave the survey aside, let's leave Yasser. I mean, you need Yasser. I mean, you rely on Betts, and the other side has an argument that if we're talking about just the 787 patent, which I'm talking about, that hadn't even issued when Betts was practicing. Is that not relevant in your view? Is that not a persuasive argument?
Maybe I misunderstood. I thought Your Honor was going to ask me about the cross-link that's referenced in the JMAL order. There's 2 points in the JMAL order at Appendix 12... or Appendix 61 through 62 that are the 3 reasons for why he's excluding him. He lists cross-link twice and then talks about the figure one testimony.
Uh-huh.
Was that not what your question was about?
I guess. I'm not sure. You can answer.
Okay, because there's 2 parts where that comes up. There's what I just mentioned, which is referencing what's stated in the JMAL at 61, 62. The issues with the cross-link there, frankly, I don't really understand because they don't have anything to do with the claims, okay? The cross-link across the spine does not have to have its own handle. There's nothing in any of the claims that requires the cross-link to have a handle. What I think the judge is saying is, why can the cross-link also be something designed especially to be grasped by the hand? Because it's a surgical tool used that way. But also, that's completely irrelevant to any of the claims in the 358 and the 121. What happens in a cross-link is, can the cross-link be part of the handle means? Absolutely. Handle means does not mean
right,
handle.
Just focus on the 787 now,
sure.
Which doesn't have handle means.
Correct.
What is the what was the ground for saying there is insufficient evidence? And I think 787 claim 6 is a method claim, so the doctor actually has to be creating the linking.
Yes.
Right?
Understood.
Across the spine.
So if Yasser is completely excluded. So ignore the fact that the simultaneous application of force across the spine would be included in using a cross-link, because that's the whole point of the cross-link, and that was the testimony that he gave on direct examination. If his testimony is completely excluded, and we're taking all the inferences in light of Dr. Barry's side, you take what Dr. Betts said, which is that he built it and did a construct that's fully infringing all three patents, ignore the time part for a second. Then you take Dr. O'Brien, who testified that in the last 5 years, he's aware that surgeons do that construct, and that's at, apologies, that's at Dr. O'Brien testifies at Appendix 8602 and 8608 through 09 that if you do the kind of fully length boxed constructs, I know that's a technique that people use, and he's been asked that in the last 5 years. So circumstantial evidence to show direct infringement is completely acceptable. This is all adds up to circumstantial evidence that even for the 787, it was being done.
Okay. Well, let's hear the other side and restore some time for rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. This is a case about judicial discretion. Judge Diamond did exactly what Daubert, Rule 702, and ultimately Rule 50 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure obligated him to do, and he did it with reasoned, extensive, comprehensive opinions. In excluding Yasser and Neal, he carried out his gatekeeper functions under Daubert and acted well within his broad scope of discretion. As to Yasser, he properly excluded Dr. Yasser's testimony because it contradicted his claim construction. Judge Stark, you're exactly right. When everything is a handle, nothing is a handle. And that's what his testimony ended up being.
Where did he say that on direct? It seems to me that what happened was you all did not object to any of his testimony on direct as being inconsistent with the claim construction or beyond the scope of what he had disclosed in his expert disclosures. Mm-hmm. And then you have an admittedly very effective cross-examination from your colleague in which he gets the expert to say certain things that you then end up not even having to go to a jury because the cross was so good, you persuaded the judge there can't possibly be enough evidence here. That doesn't sound like a proper use of the rules of evidence or the directed verdict rule.
With regard to the very effective cross, what the very effective cross did is to draw out what he had already said on direct. Because if you look, for example, at page 26 of our red brief, we have the slide that we put up in front of Dr. Yasser, where we showed that while he was paying what Judge Diamond called lip service to his claim construction, the construction he was actually using is a part that cannot be assembled without grasping it by the hand.
Those are a few words cleverly selected from about 10 pages of transcript testimony that he gave on direct, in which he repeatedly says, I'm applying the court's claim construction, and he repeats it word for word several times.
And that is the sort of testimony that this court frequently dismisses as ultimately conclusory when the full body of the testimony shows that he was in fact not applying that testimony.
Can I just ask, how often did he make this point about assembly requiring grasping as opposed to use requiring grasping? The manipulation part. As the assembly part does seem, I don't know, oddly a stretch to me. Mm-hmm. But did he say that more than once or just in this one part that you put in?
I think he said it repeatedly, if my recollection is correct. But the point is, whether it's assembly or whether it's use, the point is that what he was saying was a handle isn't a handle. And Judge Diamond was laser focused on this from the claim construction argument. My friend has already told you about worries that DePue had in the claim construction process, that what they were going to try to do with this construction, which, by the way, was the agreed construction from the Texas case, the one that they agreed to in the Texas case. And my friend here was asked by Judge Diamond very specifically, is it a construct that is designed especially to be grasped by the hand, a part that is designed to especially be grasped by the hand, or that can be grasped by the hand. And my friend's answer was, the construction from the Texas case, which is what Dr. Berry is sticking with, is a part that is designed especially to be grasped by the hand.
What did Dr. Yassir say at trial that was materially different than what he had said in his deposition and his expert report when you lost, without prejudice, but lost right. the Daubert motion? What was different, materially different, about his testimony at trial?
Well, I think that we already were seeing in the deposition this effort to sort of morph from the actual construction.
Well, to the extent that's true, it hurts you because Judge Diamond implicitly reviewed all of that and said, I'm fine with this testimony.
Tentatively fine. But we're going to see how this comes out at trial. And that's the nature of a motion in limine. Now, Daubert does not have to be presented to a judge on a motion in limine. It can be raised when the expert gives a testimony.
Do you have any examples of cases where a judge renews or allows the renewal of a Daubert and rules on it after the party who you've moved against has rested their case so that they have no opportunity to clean up whatever the judge may have thought went wrong? And I would just add gratuitously, where the judge had seemed to have blessed them preparing their case on exactly this grounds prior to trial.
Well, we've cited cases in our brief that say that the discretion that is given to district judges under Rule 702 even allows them to grant Daubert motions sua sponte. So I think by extension, that understanding of Rule 702. And again, this notion of due process, Judge Stark, I think it's important to keep in mind. This is a Rule 104A obligation that they had to make the case that their expert was reliable. And they were on notice from the claim construction that Dr. Yassir was being seen by Judge Diamond as shifting in his views, and that was going to be something that he was going to take a close look at trial. And ultimately he determined, and by the way, I think there was some colloquy with my friend about whether this was just a Rule 403 exclusion. It's also a Rule 702 exclusion. Because
for Yassir?
Yes. At page A62, the judge said that his testimony was contradictory, unhelpful, and unreliable.
Right. My recollection is that the district court referred, with respect to Neal, to both 702 and 403, with respect to Yassir, only to 702. And I don't remember that he broke it down between 702A about helpful or the remaining parts of 702, which is a sort of reliability.
As I understand that portion of Rule 702, it's not a whole lot different than the 403 standard of helpfulness. But in any event, what his finding was that it was both unhelpful and unreliable. So that I think you have elements of both. But again, this is a very discretionary call on the part of the judge.
What would be unreliable about testimony about what one would infer was especially designed to be grasped by the hand? I don't get the reliability notion with respect. I get it with respect to Neal, but with respect to Yassir, just explain it to me.
Well, I think the unreliability aspect of it is that it's just not following his claim construction because he wasn't talking about inferences about designed especially.
Why isn't your friend on the other side right that this is really a dispute about the application of the claim construction? Because I think you have to admit, even Judge Diamond did, he at minimum paid lip service to the claim construction. If an expert's going to testify, I applied the construction, and then you think you elicit some testimony inconsistent with that, why isn't that all going to the weight and the application of the construction?
Because claim construction is supposed to set the boundaries of the invention. That's why Markman announced in 1995 that was for the court, and that's the law of the case. What Dr. Yassir did in this case was to come up on the stand and say, yeah, I realize we proposed that in Texas, and I realize that Judge Diamond said this, but I like something different.
But and, you know, I mean, okay, I understand your arguing.
But that's not a jury question.
We all know he didn't say that.
Well, he didn't use those literal words, but that's the import. And that's what Judge Diamond took away from his testimony. And that's why we give judges like Judge Diamond discretion in this circumstance. And I think Judge Diamond had the full picture of
what... Can we come back to my earlier question?
Sure.
I may have cut you off, not giving you a chance to answer. Is it correct that there were no objections on direct? That on direct, you never stood up and tried to protect the record?
No, I think that's actually wrong, and I believe that we had an objection to his testimony. And again, I don't want to just stand here and flip through the appendix and waste your time.
No, I don't want to do that.
My recollection is that we initially tried to object when he started using different terminology. But that said,
whether it's this case or another, I guess, if the record is you stand silent on direct, and then on cross, you reveal the inner workings of the expert's mind, and arguably those are inconsistent with the literal claim construction, are we really supposed to say that this expert never should have testified, and now we should strike him because even though he is saying he applied the claim construction and got through direct without any objections on this point, on cross, you reveal that really, in his heart of hearts, he doesn't believe it.
Well, remember, of course, that we did have that objection even before trial started.
Which
we tentatively lost, but it was still in play. We certainly could not have relied on that loss and said, well, we've preserved this issue had we not made this argument at trial, because Judge Diamond said explicitly this is necessarily tentative. And by the way, redirect was available. Redirect, if there was any sort of notion of unfairness here, he could correct that. But the fact is that what he was doing was equating a very different concept.
Okay, I'm sorry to keep coming back to this, but anything you can say on what if it's all just very effective cross-examination? Should that expert be stricken?
If it shows that they failed to make their case under Rule 104A by a preponderance of the evidence that this testimony was reliable, then yes. That is not reliability under Rule 104 is a preliminary question for the court. It is not a jury question. And that's where I come back to the fact that this case is all about judicial discretion.
Okay, running out of time, so you know we covered a lot of issues with your friends. Why don't you move to kind of the points that Judge Toronto was making on the survey?
Yes, okay, so the survey was frankly terrible. It was not the same survey, first of all.
I know, what was the use, though? What use can be put to the survey? I think that was part of the questioning here, in terms of establishing that at least there's one use, as opposed to establishing the quantity of use for purposes of damages.
So the unreliability of the survey casts doubt on even drawing that conclusion from the survey. That's the real problem. And again, I come back to discretion. The survey was found to be unreliable. It was shown to be unreliable. And that means that the outcome of the survey was bad because the process of design of the survey was bad. We don't know in this case, for example, whether or what, because of the problems with the survey. Let me give you, by the way, I should have finished that sentence. We don't know whether or what, if any, things were practiced by surgeons using the DePuy instruments with any reliability. And now, let me tell you why that is the case. We pointed out in our brief that there are problems with both representativeness and the flawed question design. The flawed question design is a big problem here because it starts with what is the so-called anchor question 14.
No, we understand that from
right.
the briefing, so
but,
why don't you just go
but
to the
problem is that the output of that is not reliable. And how do
even
we know?
Even to establish one instance of
not even what it doesn't. It's not even reliable to establish one instance. And I'll explain why that is. The survey is so bad that when you compare it, for example, to the Medtronic survey, which, by the way, was challenged in this court on only one very narrow ground, the 2016 Medtronic survey said that Medtronic was occupied 28% of the market. The DePue survey 2 years later took that down to 14%. By contrast, when you compare them, the DePue survey in this case, the 2018 survey, had 62% of the use of Expedium, one of the DePue products, were infringing procedures. But in the 2 years prior, it was only 25. That goes to what was said to be the pretest that Dr. Neal said that he did. The Medtronic survey, he said, was an adequate pretest. Judge Diamond said there was a complete absence of pretesting. He was right and well within his discretion to say that makes this survey unreliable.
I'm confused by that. Judge Diamond, as best I can tell, doesn't cite any evidence that any of his criticisms actually would make a difference to a survey methodologist. Am I correct about that?
But when you say evidence, I mean...
I mean evidence. I mean, like, well, your expert.
Because this is, again, this is not... we're not comparing the experts here on this issue. This is a preliminary question of reliability and thus admissibility. And Judge Diamond is saying that what Dr. Neal didn't do was create a reliable survey.
How does Judge Diamond know that, and how do I know that he was right?
We know that from the testimony that he gave, the cross-examination, and the law in this area.
No. Dr. Neal never said, I admit it, everything I did made my survey unreliable.
Yes, and I'm at the red light, but I'm sure you want an answer, so let me answer your question. Yes, of course Dr. Neal said that, in the same way that Dr. Yassir said what he said with regard to the claim construction. But the problem is that once both the direct examination and then the cross-examination came out, it was very clear that he had violated the basic principles of surveys in the scientific manual, at the Federal Judicial Center scientific manual, as well as the case law that we provided to the court.
And no expert was necessary to tie that together. It's enough. It's within a judge's discretion to... by the way, take over the direct examination and basically cross-examine the expert while he's on the stand, and then find secondary sources and say, because I don't like the way this survey looks, it's definitely unreliable.
Well, with respect, Judge Stark, I don't think that's a fair description of what Judge Diamond did here. It wasn't just, I don't like how the survey looks. What he said was, it is, and I repeat, because this is an evidentiary issue, it is a preliminary question under Rule 104A for them to show that their expert was reliable. And reliability isn't just whatever they say goes. Reliability can get tested by cross-examination. And those preliminary questions, as the Supreme Court in Borghelli and other cases have made clear, that's to be done by the court, the court's own findings by a preponderance of the evidence. That isn't the Rule 50 standard here. That's the court making a determination as to whether this is good enough, whether this is reliable enough to go in front of a jury.
Can I ask you one final question?
Yes, please.
I'm not cutting off my colleagues, but just one point. You don't dispute, do you, that if in fact we uphold the striking of Yasser's testimony, that's his testimony only with respect to handles, not necessarily
right.
With respect to cross-linking?
I think that's the only fair reading of Judge Diamond's ruling, is that he struck the testimony with regard to handle means. The 787 comes out because of the complete lack of evidence of infringement. You asked my friend some questions on that during his argument. I think either Judge Prost, it was you, or Judge Stark, who pointed out quite correctly that the evidence of Dr. Betts, he stopped using these DePue products in 2014.
But then his answer to that was the other testimony from the other.
And then his
that he observed it being
somebody
used.
He'd heard of some other people using it, and I think under any standard that this court would use for substantial evidence, that would not qualify as substantial evidence of infringement.
Just one more.
Please.
I think I understand their alternative request is at least let us have a trial without Yasser's handle means testimony and without Neal. If we were considering doing that, and I don't know if we are, is there a world in which we don't have to reach the expert issues? particular Yasir because, you know, maybe Judge Diamond would want to give him another chance to not just pay lip service to the testimony, you know, to stick more closely on cross to what he said on direct. I don't know. Exercise his discretion again. Or would your view be, even if we're sending it back for a new trial, so arguably whatever happened at the first trial is now moot, you think we need to decide the expert issues, whether we think Judge Diamond got it right, essentially.
If you were to send it back, I think he's made a final decision with regard to Yasir and with regard to Neil.
Thinking about this a little bit in advance of today's argument, it seemed to me maybe there's a distinction between Neil and Yasir. Yasir's problem was his testimony. If he gave different testimony, you might cross-examine him on why it was different, but that new testimony might adhere to the claim construction in a way that has been found that his earlier testimony didn't. The problem with Neil, the basis for the Neil exclusion, is the way he conducted the survey, and that's not curable by just testifying differently about it.
Well, I'd be hesitant, Judge Toronto. I understand the distinction you're drawing. Let's start there. But I'd be very hesitant to endorse the notion that what we need to do is we need to let Dr. Yasir have another shot at trying to explain himself. And here, I do want to point out before I leave here that Dr. Yasir has been their expert all throughout, even the Medtronic litigation and before in the Medtronic IPRs. And in the PTAB proceedings in the Medtronic IPR, Dr. Yasir said, and I quote, "Posts are not handle means." And he, of course, went that direction to try to save the patents from an invalidity challenge. But what then the problem is that the fundamental difference between the products that DePuy puts on the market and Medtronic's products is that Medtronic's products had a handle. Everybody agreed. It wasn't even an issue. They had to find a handle here.
Yeah.
And the record here that Dr. Yasir has made was it was increasingly clear as the trial was approaching and then as the trial actually began to take place that Dr. Yasir was not holding to the construction that got them the win in the Medtronic case.
Thank you.
Unless the court has any further questions, again, I'd hope to give you back some time, but it was not to be.
All right. We'll restore 2 minutes of your time.
Three quick points. Judge Prost, you asked for record sites for you to see your testifying evidence about the simultaneous application of force.
Mm-hmm.
It's Appendix 1245, where he describes why a surgeon would build on both sides in order to use it, and then again on cross at 1294, where he's engaged with cross saying, "I guess I disagree. Are you asking me, can they be used at one time? I don't see how they wouldn't be used together. So you're telling me it's impossible? No, I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm saying a person of skill in the art would use them together. That's what a surgeon do. You're not going to waste time and build a tool like that and not use it." Judge Stark and Judge Toronto, when my friend was talking, got to an interesting point about what happens with the cross-examination. A point I didn't get to make in my beginning was this wasn't even cross about the application. None of these questions on cross ever had to do with how Dr. Yasir applied the construction to the accused products. This was revisiting claim construction. Judge Toronto, what happens when we go back? This testimony will get excluded. The judge, the cross-examination testimony that we've been talking about all day will be excluded. Because if what they're saying is correct, which is what they're asking Dr. Yasir, didn't you use a different construction and introduce that construction? That violates the court's in limine order. The court's in limine order said no party will introduce testimony about a different claim construction than mine. The only reason this was acceptable, we can keep calling it effective cross, but the only reason it was acceptable effective cross is because it had to do with application. How Dr. Yasir was explaining to the jury, this is why a part shown in the patent is a handle means. On the who proffered the testimony going back to PTAB, my friend is incorrect. That is what he said, because he's arguing about what a handle means are. Even in the course of this argument, we are not using the term correctly. The claim term is not handle. It is handle means. handle means only exist. And this, we cite this in the brief. I already cited some Markman testimony today where this is confirmed. You had to link multiple posts together. One post does not have a handle means. That was the point. At page 6 of our brief, we have a picture of that.
Okay.
Can I address one thing on Neil?
Just one thing, and don't abuse your moderation.
I will. Just the one thing on Neil I wanted to say is, the question on the Daubert challenge, and then what can we use it for, his argument and response, citing things like third-party market data and stuff to show that it was not reliable, that's a conclusion problem. That's not a methodology problem. Dr. Neil used the same methodology as in the GlaxoSmith case and the Roche case, both from the Third Circuit, cast a wide net, explained how that was, compared it to third-party market data, and said, that is how I know my survey is reliable. Zero evidence came in on the other side that what he did was wrong,
okay,
just that there were criticisms.
Thank you. We thank both sides. The case is submitted.